Welcome to The Future Built Smarter, a podcast in which IMEG engineers discuss innovative and trend-setting building and infrastructure design with architects, owners, and others in the AEC industry. I'm your host, Joe Payne, and with me again today is IMEG's Vice President of Innovation, Mike Lawless. Mike, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm great. Great to be here again. It's always fun, Joe.
And also with us from IMEG is Adam McMillan. He is our Director of Sustainability. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Joe. Yeah, thanks for having me back on again.
Our guest today is Kat Klingenberg. Kat is the Executive Director and co-founder of the nonprofit Passive House Institute US, or FHIUS. She has presented at many national and international conferences. She's a past recipient of the Women in Sustainability Leadership Award and is a senior fellow at the New Buildings Institute. Kat, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, I'm very, very excited to be here and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
I know eventually we're going to talk about your organization's collaboration with this year's Green Build Conference, but before then, for those who might not be familiar with FHIUS, tell us about Passive House and how your organization works to promote the Passive House building movement.
Yeah, sure. So FHIUS is a nonprofit organization, and we are the leading building certification organization and education organization that promotes and implements passive building principles. We certify buildings, as I said. We certify professionals. We also certify products. We create and try to develop new tools that make it easier for professionals to design passive buildings and to successfully implement passive buildings. And when I talk about the passive building principles, I mean, this is really not any rocket science, right? Essentially, this is good building science best practice. We're talking about continuous insulation, airtight construction, no thermal bridging in the envelope, good fenestration components, and minimized mechanical systems. So it's all about holistic integrated design. And once that is all implemented correctly, we get the result of like super low energy buildings that are pretty much zero energy ready.
So Kat, when we talk about passive houses, are we just talking about residential houses? We're talking about more than that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So you started out with mentioning the term passive house, and we can talk about this a little bit in more depth later, but we at FHIUS actually, we have rebranded not too long ago. We now go by the word FHIUS and no longer by the Passive House Institute US, because as we have evolved over the years, we were founded in 2003. We have graduated basically from building single family homes to multifamily, smaller, and then the multifamily projects got larger and larger. We've certified quite a few high-rises by now and also quite a few commercial buildings. So at that point, we decided that it was time to kind of skip the term passive house because it's somewhat confusing, right? It really applies to all buildings, to all building typologies, new and retrofit construction. So we generally try to talk about it as passive building principles. As I said, applying to all building typologies.
In 2003, what led you down this path? I mean, obviously you're having a really significant impact, but I'm sure there's a kind of a why did you start and a little bit of how you got to where you are now.
Well, by training, I'm an architect, and I started my career here in the U.S. With Helmut Jahn, one really fantastic architect here in Chicago. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago, They were already doing quite a few very interesting and innovative things in terms of energy efficiency, but I was very much aware of the climate crisis and it wasn't going far enough at all. So I started researching what else could be done to reduce energy consumption in buildings and to tackle the emissions in the built environment. And I came across the Passive House Institute in Germany. started studying what they were doing and started teaching myself using their design tool and also translating it into IP from Metric, right? Like it only existed in German at the time. I also translated it into the English language. So that was quite a heavy lift. And then I built my own house in Champaign-Urbana. And at that point, I still had absolutely no idea that, like, really, this was already basically what I call it now, Passive House 2.0, because Passive House 1.0 already started in the 60s and was well established in the 70s and early 80s. You guys are probably all very much aware of this, that by the end of, mid 80s, somewhere around there, there were already about like 30,000 Passive House units in North America, in Canada, and in the US. So the passive building principles that we promote now, and that in Passive House 2.0, the Germans promoted, they are all the same, like right from the beginning. Those were the five ones that I just quoted: insulation, good envelope, good windows, small mechanical systems. So now in 2002, I decided as an architect to found an organization that would build passive houses for affordable homeowners, because that seemed to be the right fit, right? Like, if you can eliminate the energy burden through utility bills, we are already quite a bit a ways ahead, and also we are helping the climate, so it seemed like a win-win. And we built the first affordable home after I finished my home under a community housing development grant program from the city of Urbana. And while we were building that, like, the DOE took notice, and they sent their researchers out and asked if they could monitor our project that we were building. And of course, they were reminded of what had been going on in the 80s. And they thought that we were kind of crazy trying to promote these very high levels of airtightness again, but they were intrigued. And so this is how our relationship with the Department of Energy started. And we started becoming partners with Building Science Corporation a little later. We started doing training across the country because people had heard about what we were doing. And all the while, we were still using the European standard, the one-size-fits-all passive house standard. But then we very quickly realized the United States has a lot of different climates. And while that was a big challenge, it was also a great opportunity, because we were learning that you really need different standards for different climates. So we embarked on Passive House 3.0, I like to call it. In 2015, we published, together with Building Science Corporation, the still unique climate-specific passive building standards. And those, once we had those, like, certifications took off. It really made it much more applicable, easier to do, much more affordable. We used some pretty involved calculations to cost optimize, not only to climate optimize. So by now we have a set of standards that we feel very much guides the designer to the sweet spot between energy conservation and generation on the path to zero.
As mechanical engineers, Adam and I, you're really trying to minimize what we design into the building, which is great, because that's the most efficient it can be.
Yeah, once you really put the effort into the envelope, your mechanical system can get reduced to almost nothing. And this is where it gets super interesting to me, too, because so the heat pump technology has come a long way, right? Like, so essentially all of our projects, even large high-rises, they all are having heat pump systems now, BRF, point source, or what have you, depending on the building size. And most recently, also New York City passed a law, so now they also have to switch their hot water systems to all electric, so heat pumps again. So the historic connection here is, like, in the 60s, this is the most fascinating story. There were apparently a few people in Alabama who built super insulated houses in Alabama in the 60s. And their idea was, we want to use a heat pump, which at the time was not very powerful. So they had to upgrade the envelope to make the system work. So really, the secret sauce of passive buildings, the way we know them today and the way we promote them and we like to see them constructed. Really, the key ingredient is a micro mechanical system. So you start with a mechanical system. You want to make that as small as possible, and then make the envelope do the rest of the work.
So I grew up in an envelope house in the 80s.
Double envelope?
Yeah, all the way around.
Fascinating. Plus
the solarium on the south side. My grandfather was really into studying it, and even put earth tubes that went all the way around the house, and we pumped air through the earth tube. That part never really worked. But I don't know if that's passive house or what. This is what he built.
Well, this was one of the early iterations and experiments, right? Like, William Shurcliffe, an MIT professor, he was also part of the Manhattan Project, but somehow got written out of the Oppenheimer. Once he was done with that career, he decided to focus on passive solar homes. And he started to write about it in the 70s. And he studied double envelope houses. He studied super insulated houses. And he tried to kind of like formulate the system and those kind of foundational passive building principles. And really, a lot goes back to his work and his publications. And I know the double envelope houses just from his publications, but I thought they were absolutely fascinating. And really, I mean, all the experimentation of like, how can we use ambient energy? Like, how can we reduce the energy that we need in the first place? Fascinating, right? Like, we found out later that maybe double wall envelopes are not so great when, in case of fire. Or in the end, I think they all zoomed in on like the right balance between passive solar and insulation, and that's still the case. And a micro load system.
And so, Kat, today, obviously, with the growing effort toward decarbonization, this is just fits right in with all of that, and really is where everything should sort of begin with for buildings, right?
Yes. And it's super exciting, actually. I mean, it's almost like the perfect storm, right? We got the heat pump technology to where we need it. We it's not rocket science, like the envelope technologies, airtightness. Once builders got the airtightness strategies down, it's not a problem anymore. Like, people initially are afraid of it, but once they figure out the techniques, they're like, oh, that was nothing, you know? So teams are readily achieving pretty strict airtightness standards by now without really a lot of investment or difficulty. So, but what is really, really great is because we're in this situation where theoretically we need to electrify everything, the existing building stock. Now, if we don't go the reduced load path first, and if we don't energetically upgrade all of our existing buildings, guess what happens, right? Like right now, everybody, especially in the Midwest, everybody's gung-ho about electrification and heat pumps. But if they do that without upgrading the envelope, guess what? We need like 10 times the grid we already have. And that is way too expensive. Nobody can afford this, right? So really where policymakers are now seeing great opportunity, at least the forward-thinking policymakers like in Massachusetts. Starting this year, FEAS passive building has de facto become code in the opt-in stretch code for multifamily buildings larger than 12,000 square feet. And this is really an incredible development. Like an entire industry is retooling like in like light speed. It's amazing. The builders, the verifiers, the envelope commissioners, the architects, the mechanical engineers, and they didn't have very much time to prepare for this. And apparently it works. It's being done. And so this is the first really large experiment on a state level, if this will fly. And we've shown that these multifamily buildings can be built for a cost premium of roughly 2% with our cost optimized standards. So the developers are saying, like, I cannot afford not to do it. So it's a very exciting moment in time.
You mentioned, you know, the existing building stock. You know, obviously when you've got existing structures and as you said, if we just electrify those things without dealing with other parts of those buildings, you know, there's a lot of challenges there. What kind of guidance or what kind of discussions are happening around, you know, these sorts of standards for existing buildings?
that's a tough nut to crack, right? Last couple of rounds of lots of DOE funding went towards trying to figure out how to industrialize envelope upgrades, how to spur an industry that produces these panels that can easily be put on buildings from the outside without having to move people. And that's not going very quickly, I'd say. Now, that said, it's also the question, what is the right standard for the existing building stock? Would like something like the new construction FEAR standard, would that like translate one-to-one? Because that's what we have been kind of like doing along the way. We're like, well, there's really no reason that like an existing building should get more of a break than a new building. We have to get to zero, so we need everything we can save. But turns out that now, because everybody has been so tardy in their responses, we have so little time left. Let's say we have like now about 15, 20 years to retrofit the entire building stock. And if we now go to like very deep energy retrofit levels, so new construction FEAR standards in terms of insulation applications, like it's almost like we're kicking the planet in the butt, like in a too short period of time with embodied carbon from materials. So we've gone back to the drawing board and reconsidered our standard setting, and we came up with a new framework to basically optimize how much can we reduce the insulation level from where we are for new construction without losing the resilience benefit in a building. So because that's important, the grid will become kind of shakier as we're going through this transition. And and how much carbon in initial upfront investment in insulation can we save? That's another optimization exercise, if you will, right? And then we're adding like a measurement to the whole standard that measures your life cycle carbon with an eye towards having to go to zero carbon by 2050.
Yeah, you mentioned resilience in there, and I think that's to me, that's really an interesting one as we look at, you know, different areas of the country having more, you know, natural sort of events of, you know, heavy rainstorms in Southern California and, you know, more hurricanes and sort of some of those different impactful events that are occurring. Obviously, the mechanical systems and those things in a building, they need power, which can be impacted. You know, how does that resilience help these projects, you know, long-term be able to serve their users? And also, I mean, the other thing that I'm really curious about is like insurance, you know, and as insurance becomes an issue in some of these areas, does this resilience that comes along with the passive house standards, does that help with insurance rates or insurability as well?
Yeah. So to the first part of your question, how does it help homeowners and their buildings, the resilience piece, right? How does it make their lives safer, easier, better? So there was the example in Texas a couple of years ago when temperatures dropped for a very long time below freezing. Remember that? People were starting to cut up their houses and started having fires and because they just couldn't stay warm. One of our certified projects is in Austin, Texas, and it is a passive house. And they didn't have to leave the building. The temperature in the building never dropped below 50 degrees. They eventually had to leave because they didn't have a small backup system. Now, after this experience, they did install one for their solar system. So as soon as you have a small backup system, it's absolutely perfect, right? They had a baby at the time. They didn't have this backup system. So eventually, like, they didn't have a fridge. They had to leave anyway. But if you had that small backup system, so this is how we're kind of like trying to zoom in on this resilience rating system that we're establishing. It's no longer just focused on the passive measures, because in warm climates, that just doesn't work. insulation will not help you from overheating. So we're designing essentially an envelope that can keep a family safe and in place during very extreme weather events for 7 days, coldest event and hottest event. And a small backup system, solar and battery, has to be designed to guarantee that, as well as the envelope has to be perfect in terms of like what level of insulation. And your second part of your question, the insurance companies, right? There's nothing in place yet, but they are starting to pay attention. And I have a strong inclination that in the next coming years, there will be a rate cut for passive projects. And we are trying to actively have that conversation with them.
Yeah, because there's record, you know, you read about insurance rate increases. And I mean, even in Missouri, which we're pretty insulated from, you know, where I live from flooding and a lot of those things, you know, there's even rate increases there, and they're even larger, you know, in Florida and Texas and those things. And as an engineer, I can't help but think, well, if you built your house different, you probably would have less impact from those things, and you should pay less in insurance. And so that resilience piece of it, I think is it could be sort of a selling point too going forward for folks potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the new retrofit standard framework that we're developing, Revive 24 is what we're calling it. We're actually including the fortified standard that looks at all these things, like, right, what should you be doing to fortify against floods, hail, fire, hurricane. So in wildfire conditions, also passive houses excel because they have a ventilation system. So you filter out the contaminants and you have good indoor air quality.
So tell us about the collaboration with Green Build that's coming up this year. What that is exactly, and how that's going to change the landscape of Green Build this year, I guess.
Yeah, so this is very exciting to me. I have been working on this kind of like a collaboration and friendship between US Green Building Council and FIES for quite a while. And we have already like some collaborations, like they give FIES a certain amount of points. If you do FIES certification, you don't have to kind of like go through the detailed process for the energy and atmosphere credits. We've tried to kind of like harmonize for commercial buildings, but the progress has been slow. And so eventually, about a year ago, we were all a bit frustrated. And we're like, man, the climate crisis is knocking on the door. We have more and more extreme events. And people are confused in the market. They don't know what is LEED, what is FIES. Like they think it's like all you choose one or the other, and they don't understand how they really should fit together, right? Like they are synergistic rating systems. We focus on the energy piece, envelope and mechanicals, and like the LEED system really is this whole broader context on top of it. So I always try to describe it as like FIES is like a computer. This is Intel lives inside, or that's how it should be. So finally, to kind of counteract this confusion in the market and to help educate all of our stakeholders, we forged this collaboration, and we decided that FIES should have a track within Green Build this year. So we call it FIES at Green Build. We're not going to do our own FIES Con as we have done in the past. And we're going to be right there, and we hope that we can create a lot of interest in what we do and bring the stakeholders of Green Build into the fold and help them with their next challenges, as like policies will likely follow Massachusetts' example, right? So people will have to come up to speed, and that doesn't happen overnight. There's a bit of a learning curve.
You know, groups have had different versions of passive houses, of using, you know, before there was air conditioning, like my house was built in the 40s. I mean, I've got windows on both sides with screens, and you can open them up and you get a really nice cross breeze. And that's there because there was no air conditioning. So after learning for the first time that Adam used passive house principles for his addition, Adam, if you're doing an addition to your house, or you're doing something new, a renovation, what are some of the first things that people should think about as they're doing those things?
I think simplifying your design to a spot where you can still have beautiful homes, but when we put dormers and gables and all these layers of roofs, which look really great, they become very hard to insulate. And I think the details and architecture are getting a lot better at thinking about how you construct that, where you can kind of get the insulation and envelope nice and tight and continuous underneath, and then layer the other stuff on top that looks nice. And there's a lot of good designs for that. But it's kind of a rethinking. I mean, you mentioned, Mike, like if you had to design your house, if it didn't have air conditioning, you would change the shape, you would change the number of windows, you would change all those things. So I think there's a little bit of that mindset that comes in into that, along with then how can you also make it look like these other homes? Because the homes you see go up today, like, they don't care about a deep core because you're going to put a gaming room in the middle and you're not going to see the light of day for 3 weeks, you know? And that's just, you know, there's some competing priorities sometimes, or even lot sizes and things like that. So I think there's just a whole, like, how do you, what shape you draw the box? I think that changes a lot too. And then I think the second is the type of insulation you choose matters. When I did my garage, I used XPS because it was continuous and rigid, but now embodied carbon-wise, that's a no-no. So, but now Dow has a low XPS, low carbon XPS, right? So you kind of got to follow the latest trends on building materials because they do matter these days. The manufacturers that are doing it right get it on both operational and embodied carbon too. So I think those are some of the places to start. I think the other thing that gets missed is, I think about our projects, we do a lot of really large healthcare, we do a lot of lab, some pretty energy intensive buildings. With electrification, the envelope is much different because the kW charge running a heat pump is enormously big compared to a gas bill, which doesn't care about the time of year. So I almost see a resurgence in BS with electrification because electric systems are just going to have a really big spike, and utilities aren't, you know, like I say, they aren't dumb. They're going to know where they get their money. And I think those rate charters will follow. So I think the architect has some things to think about in a different order. And I think the engineer has got some things to think about in a different order as well. And it's even more of a call to make those things work together.
So Kat, I guess as people, you know, Adam shared a little bit about his story and his thoughts, maybe wrap us up with, hey, if somebody is looking to get started or somebody's interested, you know, where should they go? What should they do? I know you have a lot of great resources out there.
Yeah, our website is a great place to start, right? Like lots of articles, publications that live in the resource library. We have a database of certified projects. If you just want to go in and browse, like what kind of projects have been built in my climate zone, what kind of materials have people been using. So that's kind of like a nice high level, just skimming what's out there. And then if and when you decide you want to embark on your project, find yourself a professional like Adam, a CPHC, Certified Passive House Consultant, who can run the energy model. We also now, for single family homes, have a prescriptive path that essentially the homeowner could run themselves if they wanted to. It's a little bit more conservative, so you'll probably use a little bit more material. So the CPHC is probably always the better kind of option, performance-based design, optimized. And the CPHC will know who else needs to be on the team, like the radar verifier, the people who do the blower door test your building if it's really airtight, and test all the minimized equipment in the end if it's really that efficient as it was specified in the model. And once all that is done, well, I still recommend certification. Some people just say like, oh yeah, good enough, I got the principles. But from what we're seeing is, like, if you don't go through the process of really checking the quality, then yeah, the performance can be quite off at the end. So if you really want the result that was modeled in the energy model, you probably should go through the stages of quality assurance along the way.
Well, Kat, I really appreciate you joining us here today. I know we could talk probably for another couple hours if we wanted to, but we're not going to be able to do that. So thank you so much for being with us, and all the best to you as you continue to work with your organization and now with the coming Green Build Conference.
Yeah, thank you. That will be very exciting, and we're really looking forward to it.
That was Kat Klingenberg, the executive director and co-founder of FIAS. To learn more about the organization and its collaboration with this year's Green Build Conference, visit FIAS.org. That's PHIUS.org. Listeners who would like to hear previous episodes of The Future Built Smarter can find us on our website, imegcorp.com, or on any podcast app. We'll be back with another episode in the near future. Until then, thanks for listening and take care.